Welcome to SNC's podcast series, SNC Critical Insights. I'm Krishna Varagavan, a partner in SNC's M&A practice based in our New York office. With me today is Carsten Brar, a partner in SNC's M&A and capital markets practices. Carsten is head of SNC's Germany practice and is based in our Frankfurt office. In the last few years, Carsten and I have evaluated and worked on cross-border deals for a number of different clients. Cross-border M&A offers many unique features and challenges and represents a sizable portion of global deal activity. Every cross-border deal is, of course, different and will involve many deal-specific questions and be driven by its own dynamics. With that in mind, today we'll be discussing some topics that are generally worth considering when evaluating a cross-border M&A opportunity. The first issue we're going to cover is a hot topic these days, national security. Unlike purely domestic M&A, cross-border deals can raise national security concerns. For this reason, in many countries, federal authorities act as gatekeepers of sensitive foreign investments. In the U.S., the gatekeeper is the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, or CFIUS. CFIUS is a U.S. interagency group chaired by the Secretary of the Treasury. Generally speaking, CFIUS can review certain types of foreign investments to determine whether they pose a risk to U.S. national security. If a transaction is found to pose a threat, then CFIUS can impose conditions on the deal or recommend the President block it. Notably, the President can also unwind a foreign investment that was not pre-cleared by CFIUS. This makes it very important to understand when a foreign investment should be submitted for CFIUS review. The scope of CFIUS's jurisdiction is still being refined. Historically, CFIUS was a voluntary filing regime, but right now new rules are being adopted to implement a 2018 law expanding CFIUS's authority. One set of rules, adopted last fall, implements a pilot program for cross-border M&A involving critical technology businesses. Under the pilot program, deals that result in foreign control of a U.S. critical technology business now have to be submitted for CFIUS clearance. The same goes for certain non-controlling foreign investments in U.S. critical technology businesses. The stated intent of these rules is to ensure oversight over foreign investments that could undermine the technological edge of the United States and thereby threaten national security. In practice, the CFIUS regime has had real teeth. Last year, for example, CFIUS scuttled the unsolicited takeover of Qualcomm by Broadcom due to concerns over the future of Qualcomm's R&D into 5G wireless technology. At the time, Broadcom was organized as a Singapore company, but it has since re-domiciled back to the United States. Carsten, could you tell our listeners how national security review works in Germany?
Sure, and thanks, Krishna. Historically, foreign investment clearances have played a limited role in German inbound M&A, but their significance has strongly increased in recent years. The German Federal Ministry for Economic Affairs and Energy, or Economic Ministry, oversees the foreign investment process, which differentiates between sector-specific and general investments. Sector-specific acquisitions refer to particularly sensitive areas in terms of national security, such as military equipment or crypto technology. If a proposed M&A transaction of a foreign buyer concerns a target that is subject to sector-specific review, the buyer is under a notification obligation. The Economic Ministry opens a review which involves the Ministry of Defense and the Federal Foreign Office and may refuse to clear a transaction due to objections in terms of material security interests. Sector-specific transactions are often burdensome to clear, and when highly security-sensitive assets are allocated to a target as part of a carve-out transaction or in a subsidiary IPO, this may in effect work as a type of regulatory poison pill. Significantly more frequent are M&A transactions which are subject to the general or cross-sectoral review of the Economic Ministry, and there has been a lot of discussion lately following the takeover of robotics company KUKA by a Chinese conglomerate. Note that cross-sectoral review only concerns acquisitions of non-EU acquirers. In general, no notification obligation exists as a matter of law, and the threshold for the Economic Ministry to initiate a review process is 25% of a target's voting rights. However, over the last 2 years, the German Foreign Investment Ordinance was revised to include the concept of critical infrastructure for assets which are of particular significance to the well-being of society. The definition is broader than what one might think, and examples include the energy sector, IT, and telecommunication, or financial markets, to name a few. If the target operates in one of the 8 relevant areas, an acquisition of 10% or more of the voting rights suffices for a notification obligation to set in. These requirements are onerous for investors in public companies as they capture stake-building activities at an early stage and may require an outside-in assessment of whether a target does in fact operate critical infrastructures. Keeping with our first theme of a big picture regulatory issues, let me turn it back over to you, Krishna, to cover some of the antitrust and competition law issues that are relevant to cross-border M&A.
Thank you, Carsten. One of the first considerations in cross-border M&A is identifying the merger control regimes triggered by the deal. This can be a challenge because there are significant differences in the threshold of assets, market shares, and turnover that can trigger applicable merger controls. Information sharing and cooperation are therefore key to an efficient analysis. Once the relevant merger controls are identified, I find it's often helpful to prepare a timeline of the relevant filings and review periods. Since practices and deadlines vary by jurisdiction, a timeline provides a clear map of the process for deal participants. From a tactical standpoint, it's advisable to have an early view on how the different antitrust agencies will interact during the review process. Some authorities tend to follow the lead of the more prominent agencies, like the U.S. antitrust authorities or the European Commission. Others march to the beat of their own drummer. Typically, the best outcomes are achieved when the parties have a consistent message about the competitive effects of the deal, but tailor the narrative for local circumstances. These local circumstances could range from areas of heightened scrutiny, new theories of competition, or the local political environment. Taking a step back, the rationale for cross-border deals often hinges on a synergy assessment. The synergy assessment will make assumptions about the timeline to deal completion and the operations of the combined company. When antitrust concerns result in deal delays or unanticipated remedies, the synergy model can be compromised. Accordingly, anticipating how local authorities will react to a cross-border deal is an area where seasoned competition counsel can add real value. Now that we've covered some of the big-picture regulatory issues, let's turn to the mechanics of planning cross-border M&A. Let's start with some of the unique challenges involved in developing and managing a cross-border due diligence process. Carsten, can you provide our listeners with an overview of that?
Thank you, Krishna. When planning a cross-border due diligence process, it is helpful to first identify any differences in practice across the countries involved. For example, the buyer may be from a country where robust M&A diligence is the norm, and the seller may be from somewhere that deals are done on a diligence-light basis. Identifying and bridging these gaps is a key step. Another consideration is whether the buyer is expected to do most of its own due diligence, as it is typical for deals involving U.S. targets. European sellers, by contrast, often commission a vendor due diligence report for the buyer to rely on. Once expectations on the scope of diligence are set, I find that it's often helpful to develop a diligence work plan. Because cross-border deals can touch many jurisdictions, any deliverables expected from local counsel should be scoped up front. It's also often best for lead M&A counsel to steer the due diligence process and act as the first point of contact on diligence issues. Otherwise, the due diligence process could become sprawling, inefficient, and burdensome for the client. Another topic to be mindful of is whether the target company operates in areas that are high risk from an anti-corruption standpoint. Acquiring a business that has violated corruption or anti-money laundering laws can carry severe reputational and financial consequences. Financial institutions acting as buyers tend to be particularly sensitive in these areas. Accordingly, targeted anti-corruption due diligence, including transaction testing, is generally advisable when risks are identified. It is also noteworthy that in cross-border deals involving a publicly traded target company, a bidder may not be able to rely on any meaningful diligence beyond reviewing publicly available materials. Public targets often cite arguments of equal treatment of shareholders and point to their ongoing disclosure obligations as providing sufficient diligence materials. These arguments, along with timing constraints and competitive pressures, have worked to form a market practice which can severely limit due diligence in solicited offers for public company targets, particularly in Europe. Bidders from a different background may find this frustrating and feel that their responsibilities to shareholders and risk tolerance levels require a more in-depth diligence exercise and bespoke solutions are required. A final diligence consideration for cross-border M&A is the role that rep and warranty insurance can play. Rep and warranty insurance products have become increasingly popular in the US and have been popular in European markets for many years. In Europe, the seller's draft of the agreement in an auction process may even come with pre-negotiated, so-called stapled rep and warranty insurance attached. When a buyer plans to rely on a rep and warranty insurance, diligence planning should be tailored accordingly. Specifically, regardless of whether the insurer is European or US-based, there should be no gaps between the reps and the areas that have been covered by the buyer's due diligence. Otherwise, such areas are almost sure to be excluded from coverage. Further, the buyer should launch the diligence process under the presumption that the insurer will review buyer's diligence-related work products. In order to conduct a due diligence process, both sides of a transaction need to begin involving external advisors and in-house personnel with subject matter expertise. This broadening the tent of those knowledge of the deal increases the risk of leaks. Krishna, could you talk a bit about managing the risk of leaks in cross-border deals?
Thanks very much, Karsten. Because M&A is one of the most significant events in a company's life cycle, there are sound reasons for managing the risk of news of a potential takeover leaking out before the planned announcement. In the cross-border context, special attention should be given to the rules and regulations of the relevant jurisdictions regarding leaks. One of the more interesting regimes is the City Code on takeovers and mergers in the UK. Under the City Code, an announcement is required if, following an approach by a bidder to the board of the target company is a subject of rumor and speculation, or there is untoward movement in its stock price. An announcement is also required if, after a potential bidder first actively considers an offer, but before an approach has been made to the board of the target company is the subject of rumor and speculation, or there is an untoward movement in its stock price, and there are reasonable grounds for concluding that the potential bidder's actions led to the situation. These rules can result in a bidder having to make a potential takeover public well before it would otherwise prefer to. Following an announcement, the potential bidder has 28 days to either announce a firm intention to make a takeover offer or announce that it does not intend to make an offer. This arrangement is colloquially known as the put-up or shut-up rule. If a potential bidder announces that it does not intend to make an offer, then it will be prohibited from announcing a takeover bid for the target company for a period of 6 months.
By the way, European takeovers are subject to rules that have recently become more similar to those applicable in the UK. When negotiating a significant M&A transaction, a listed European target and bidder are delaying the disclosure of inside information as they hold back the state of negotiations, discussions around price, and other terms of the contemplated bid. Once a news report gets published and substantiated rumors arise in the market abuse regulation requires that the parties immediately disclose all information by what is called a leak ad hoc. This can lead to premature and undesired announcements. Now that we have covered the mechanics of preparing cross-border M&A, let's discuss a few of the key constituencies in cross-border deals, such as the role and responsibilities of a board in cross-border M&A. As you know, in Germany, stock corporations feature a two-tier system with a management and a supervisory board. Since the management board is in charge of running the business, it is their responsibility to negotiate the terms of significant M&A transactions. Foreign buyers often find the resulting dynamics counterintuitive. For example, an offer letter may be addressed to the management board of a corporation, and the supervisory board may only be involved at a stage of advanced discussions as ultimately their consent will be required. One note here on the leak risks we have just discussed. As a supervisory board is often co-determined and employee representatives will be present in board deliberations, a management board is often careful as to when it is best to involve the supervisory board as a whole. The fiduciary duties of both boards in Germany are directed towards the best interests of the company. What that means is that benefits for stakeholders such as employees, contractual partners, or even aspects of the common good can be considered besides shareholder interest. As an example, in a competitive auction, there is no strict requirement for the management board to maximize price if it thinks there are other key differentiators between the bidders. However, following the announcement of a takeover bid, a management board must generally not take any defensive action that could jeopardize the offer. There are only limited exceptions to this. For example, management may search for a competing bid or take measures that have been approved by the supervisory board. While ultimately the shareholders will have to decide on an unsolicited public offer, The position the management board and the supervisory board take carry significant weight and definitely have an impact on whether shareholders decide to tender. Krishna, could you tell our listeners how practice is different in the U.S.?
In the U.S., corporations are chartered under state law and managed under the direction of a board of directors elected by shareholders. State law, therefore, provides the baseline framework for board responsibilities in the M&A context. In some states, these responsibilities take the form of fiduciary duties that have been articulated in a series of judicial decisions. In other states, these responsibilities are set out in corporate codes. Understanding how these responsibilities must be fulfilled in the context of a cross-border deal is critical to transaction planning. For example, in Delaware, in the context of a sale of control, directors have a fiduciary duty to secure the transaction offering the best value reasonably attainable for stockholders. There are also fiduciary limitations on the level of deal protection that the directors of a company being acquired can accept. This may be a failure unfamiliar to a foreign buyer that is accustomed to locking up its deals. Another feature of U.S. board practice is relevant in the context of hostile M&A. Many states, including Delaware, provide a board of directors with flexibility to adopt reasonable and proportionate takeover defenses in response to a threat to corporate control. This gatekeeper role is distinct from some regimes, such as the U.K., where shareholders decide on the merits of an unsolicited offer. Speaking of shareholders, let's turn next to the relevance of shareholder activism to cross-border M&A. When a cross-border deal involves public companies, shareholder activism considerations should be given careful attention. In some regions, such as the United States and Europe, shareholder activism is a familiar part of the deal-making environment. In others, it is still an emerging phenomenon. Generally speaking, in the M&A context, there are two objectives activists commonly pursue. The first is often referred to as bumpetrage. This involves the activist shareholders of the target company demanding that the price being paid in a deal can be bumped up before they support it. One key to assessing the vulnerability of a cross-border deal to bumpetrage is determining what level of shareholder approval or participation is needed to complete the deal. Supermajority requirements, which exist in many countries throughout the world, make it easier for an activist to disrupt a deal. This is because there is a smaller constituency the activist needs to bring around to its cause in order to block the deal. A second and more extreme form of activism is outright opposition to a transaction. Such opposition could arise for many reasons, including disagreement with the rationale for a deal, or, on the buy side, a view that the acquirer is overpaying. When the deal being opposed is a cross-border in nature, the tactics available to activists in both countries need to be assessed. For example, do local laws allow the activists to solicit consents from shareholders to remove directors supportive to the deal? Does the country have a history of activists successfully litigating to block deals? In addition to local aspects, familiar tools such as the PR campaign will always be available. Activist campaigns in the M&A context, much like typical proxy contests, can often be grueling and highly personal. The possibility of a fight and the means of response should therefore be socialized at the outset. This is doubly true whenever deal participants are from countries where these dynamics are largely absent. Let's turn next to what is often at the center stage of a cross-border M&A deal, the definitive agreement.
Whether in the business combination agreement for a public takeover or share or asset purchase agreement in a privately negotiated transaction, there can be a substantial degree of difference in market practice between the various jurisdictions. As a matter of fact, the entire agreement may look different based upon the style used in the relevant jurisdiction. Maybe it makes sense to illustrate varying concepts using three examples. The first point that tends to deviate on both sides of the pond is the purchase price adjustment in a private deal. Many transactions in the U.S. as well as in Asia have some kind of true-up mechanism that retroactively adjusts the purchase price paid for any cash, debt, or working capital amounts to the extent they deviate from the amounts the parties expect at closing. In Europe, however, the purchase price is fixed and agreed at signing based upon an effective date that is typically in the past. To make sure that no value leaves the company between such effective date and closing, the SPA contains so-called no leakage provisions that ensure that the target company works like a locked box until closing. It is fair to say that this so-called locked box mechanism has become market standard for German law governed agreements. Secondly, Germany is generally a very seller-friendly market, and deal terms reflect that. Unlike what is commonly the case in deals in the U.S., sellers are heartstruck to accept closing conditions that permit a buyer to walk in circumstances where the target company experiences a material adverse effect in its business, and such a mag out is the exception rather than the rule. In line with the locked box concept that applies to the purchase price, a buyer is expected to take the risk of any deterioration in value of the target company after signing. As a third observation, we tend to see that U.S. buyers push for specific disclosure tailored to the reps and warranties in specific disclosure schedules to the agreement. These schedules may become expansive, but are expected to be fairly self-contained without reference to outside data. This is not the norm in German transactions. Sellers often attempt to disclose the entire contents of the data room against the reps. This means that no breach would have occurred if the sellers can go back to the data room and dig up a piece of information that discloses relevant circumstances. This limitation is very broad, and often the parties agree on some form of fair disclosure of the data room, but the approach in Europe and the US remains fundamentally different. Besides market practices, the regulatory framework differs. One notable aspect concerns employees. Krishna, could you outline the impact of labor law protections on U.S. cross-border deals?
Of course. In the United States, employees generally may be terminated on an at-will basis, and employee benefits are typically afforded under bespoke contractual arrangements rather than pursuant to laws and regulations. Accordingly, when evaluating a U.S. target, labor diligence will typically target a review of any formal employment agreements in place and any benefit or pension plans that have been adopted. When a portion of the target's company's workforce is unionized, there will typically be a requirement in the collective bargaining agreement that it be continued for its term. Unlike in some jurisdictions, however, there is no requirement to inform and consult with labor in the context of a takeover transaction. Decision-making authority is left to the board of directors, executive management, and the shareholders. How does this compare to practice in Germany, Karsten?
A share deal of a German target company does not affect existing employment arrangements, and in an asset deal, they are transferred by operation of law. German labor law offers generous protections to employees against terminations. These restrictions typically make it considerably more burdensome and costly to terminate employees as compared to other jurisdictions, and especially the U.S. On the other hand, labor law-related costs are rarely seen as a deal breaker, and a buyer should be aware of their scope if it plans a large-scale restructuring following the close of the purchase. Additionally, if the target has established a works council, it needs to be consulted and involved by the buyer following closing if restructuring measures are planned. While the works council generally cannot block entrepreneurial decisions, the reconciliation of interests and negotiation of social plans can be time-consuming and bind resources. Now that we have covered the key constituencies involved in cross-border M&A, let's conclude by discussing what happens after a deal closes, the integration of the target company with the buyer.
Cross-border acquisitions are typically structured either as a merger or a tender offer. In practice, the choice between these alternatives will depend on the consideration being used and the regulatory analysis for the transaction. Let's discuss these two structures and the related considerations in a bit more detail. The reverse triangular merger is a common cross-border transaction structure. Under the structure, a foreign buyer will form a domestic sub. That domestic subsidiary will then merge with and into the domestic target corporation. All shares in the domestic target will, upon a completion of the merger, be converted into the merger consideration, and the domestic target will survive as a 100% owned subsidiary of a foreign buyer. In a cross-border tender offer, by contrast, a bidder generally offers to purchase all outstanding shares of the target corporation for a single price. Because the choice to tender involves an investment decision, jurisdictions have adopted various sets of regulations intended to allow shareholders to tender on an informed and uncoerced basis. In the U.S., these protections are memorialized in the Williams Act. The Williams Act includes features like a requirement that the tender offer be held open for 20 business days and that the target company disclose to shareholders its position with respect to the tender offer. As a point of comparison, the German Takeover Act stipulates a minimum acceptance period of 4 weeks, followed by an additional 2-week period in case of a voluntary tender offer. The management and supervisory board of a corporation are required to share their view of the offer in a reasoned statement. As a practical matter, it's virtually impossible to acquire 100% of the shares of a target company through a tender offer alone. Many jurisdictions have therefore developed rules that allow for a bidder to squeeze out the remaining minority shareholders and acquire control. These squeeze-out regimes stem from a recognition that the benefits of a robust market for corporate control will be impaired if buyers cannot acquire 100% ownership under appropriate circumstances, as a bidder will likely have paid a control premium as part of the offer. There is a significant variation among jurisdictions in the rules regarding squeeze-outs, however. Bidders should be mindful of these differences in planning a cross-border deal.
German law, for example, knows three different forms of squeeze-out, two of which require that the bidder acquire at least 95% of the shares in the target company. The third option is a so-called merger squeeze-out. As these thresholds are substantial, squeeze-outs are not eligible to all bidders in practice, and oftentimes bidders rely on a German law particularity to integrate the target. Once the bidder secures a de facto majority of 75% in the shareholders' meeting of the target corporation, it can enter into a domination agreement. Under a domination agreement, the bidder may issue binding instructions to the management of the target company and has full access to the target's cash flows. As these rights are far-reaching, outside shareholders do not go unprotected. For one, they can litigate against the shareholder resolution approving the domination agreement, thereby delaying its effectiveness somewhere between 3 to 6 months, depending on the circumstances. Once effective, the domination agreement has to set out a guaranteed dividend and a put right for shareholders, both of which are subject to appraisal proceedings in court. These proceedings evaluate the adequacy of the compensation offered and may stretch for years, during which time the outside shareholder's put right bears interest of 5% per year. This is different from practice in the U.S. Krishna, could you tell our listeners about how squeeze-outs work in that context?
In the U.S., many states historically required a bidder to acquire 90% or similar ownership level before it could complete a squeeze-out merger without a shareholder vote. These squeeze-outs are often referred to as short-form mergers. By contrast, when shareholder approval is needed for a squeeze-out, it's referred to a long-form merger because it takes much longer time to complete. The reverse triangular merger structure I described earlier, for example, involves a long-form merger because it would require approval of the shareholders of the domestic target before it could be completed. In order to allow bidders to reach the 90% ownership threshold in a negotiated tender offer transaction, dealmakers develop the so-called top-up option. The top-up option is granted by the board of directors of the target company to the bidder in a negotiated tender offer. It allows the bidder to buy additional shares from the target company, which, when added to the shares owned by the bidder following the tender offer, allows the bidder to reach the 90% squeeze-out threshold. The top-up structure has drawbacks, however. For example, a top-up option will only be available if the target company has sufficient unauthorized share capital to issue the necessary shares. In recognition of these limitations, Delaware now permits a bidder that acquires enough shares in the tender offer to approve a long-form merger to squeeze out the remaining shareholders through a short-form merger if certain conditions are met. These conditions are set out in Section 251H of the Delaware General Corporation Law, and include terms like a requirement to provide the shareholders being squeezed out the same consideration as those that participated in the tender offer. That brings us to the end of our discussion today. Thank you for listening to S&C Critical Insights. For more information about our practice, please visit us on the web at www.sulcrom.com. For more news in M&A, check out the S&C Deal Portal, your must-read briefing on what matters today in M&A.